Penguin Random House Audio presents For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law by Randall Kennedy. Read for you by Amani Starnes. In praise of Eric Foner and Sanford Levinson. I have been blessed to know wonderful teachers. This book is dedicated to two who stand out as extraordinary models, mentors, and friends. Professor Eric Foner is the preeminent interpreter of the history of the United States. Professor Sanford Levinson is the most adventurous, independent, and wide-ranging intellectual in the American Legal Academy. For more than three decades, they have encouraged me unstintingly. I thank them for the tremendous positive difference they have made in my life. Introduction. Growing up with affirmative action. I can clearly recall watching the Jerry Lewis version of the film The Nutty Professor from a balcony set aside for African Americans in a theater in Columbia, South Carolina, in the summer of 1963. Ironically, as a 9-year-old, I perceived that Jim Crow arrangement as favoring blacks. It was far easier for us to throw candy down on the whites seated below than for them to throw things up at us. Back then, I thought that Americans were divided into teams designated by complexion. State authorities fed this perception with a chain in the middle of the road that separated whites and blacks in the area where my aunt lived, the choice to close rather than desegregate public parks, and ordinances requiring racially separate bathrooms, especially memorable for me, were the signs differentiating white ladies from black women. I was born in Columbia in 1954, the year the Supreme Court invalidated racial segregation in public schools. I visited frequently, but did not live there. Fleeing racism, like many millions of other Southern black refugees, my parents raised me and my siblings in Washington, D.C. My father once told me he feared that if he remained in the Deep South, he would kill or be killed in a racial altercation. He was a postal clerk who attended a couple of years of college at two black institutions, Dillard University in New Orleans and Southern University in Baton Rouge. My mother was a school teacher who earned an undergraduate degree from South Carolina State College, an institution created for Negroes, in order to protect the state's white university. When she sought a higher degree, she learned that that sort of study was unavailable to her in her home state. To fulfill what they perceived as their obligation under separate but equal, state authorities subsidized her tuition so that my mother could study abroad at some institution that would accept blacks. That is how she wound up as a student at New York University, where she earned a master's degree. Throughout the late 1950s and early 1960s, I enjoyed a happy childhood in a loving household. By moving north, my family did not wholly escape racism. Anti-black attitudes and practices were, and are, a national phenomenon. But what we encountered in D.C. paled in comparison with what my extended family faced in South Carolina. One of my cousins was at the civil rights protest at South Carolina State College, in which three undergraduates were murdered by state police in an episode of racially motivated violence that, while the subject of a fine book, has never received the attention it warranted. In my house, discussion about the civil rights movement was constant. From my parents, I learned to revere well-known heroes and heroines, Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, as well as lesser-known figures like James Hinton, Modjeska Simpkins, and Matthew Perry. Subsequently, I have come to appreciate with ever-deepening gratitude the benefits they pried open and that I have enjoyed as a matter of course. For one thing, I have had the privilege of attending an extraordinary array of schools that became accessible to more than a negligible number of black students only after the late 1960s. St. Albans School for Boys, 1968 through 73, Princeton University, 1973 through 77, and Yale Law School, 1979 through 82. An affirmative action ethos played a role in my admittance and flourishing at each of these selective, expensive, and powerful institutions. This ethos consists of a desire to make amends for past injustices, a commitment to counter present but hidden prejudices, a wish to forestall social disruption, and an intuition that racial integration will enrich institutions from which marginalized groups have largely been absent. Of course, I encountered invidious racial discrimination in these schools periodically, but luckily for me, the balance of my encounters along the race line were positive. I have often been shown special attention in competitive settings in which my blackness was perceived as a plus. I am quite certain that my race played a role in prompting teachers at St. Albans, the most formative of the schools I attended, to be especially helpful to me during my days as a student there. The same was true at Princeton, where I enjoyed the solicitude of William Bowen, who was then the president of the university, and Neil Rudenstein, the university provost, and later the president of Harvard. Their generosity was due, in part, to the mysterious alchemy of friendship. It was also due to their self-conscious, systematic efforts to lend special aid to promising scholars of color in America, and indeed, around the world. Throughout their distinguished careers, Bowen and Rudenstein have been highly effective practitioners of the affirmative action ethos. When I was a senior in college, considering law school, I attended a gathering that featured the Yale Law School Dean of Admissions. He distributed a document that included a chart noting the range of law school admission test, LSAT, scores of the students in the most recent entering class. I had just received my LSAT results. My score was disappointing, low enough that it did not even appear on the chart. I waited until the dean had fielded all of the other students' questions before I bashfully approached him and asked whether, given my score, I should still apply. He asked what sort of grades I had earned. When I told him that I had an A-minus average, he urged me to proceed. I won admission to Yale, Harvard, and every other school to which I applied. I had the profile of a hard worker, and I also had a halo over me, having just won a Rhodes Scholarship. In other words, without affirmative action, I would surely have gained admission to a fine law school. But in its absence, and in the face of that spectacularly mediocre LSAT score, would I have gained admission to Yale and Harvard? Maybe not. I attended Yale Law School, YLS, in the aftermath of Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, 1978. In that landmark ruling, the Supreme Court invalidated a particular affirmative action program, but upheld affirmative action in university admissions in general, if structured in a certain way and pursued for the sake of diversity. At YLS, virtually all black students supported affirmative action. Doing so was seen as a sacred communal obligation. A memorable dinnertime discussion with black peers in my first year involved the question of what to do when Bakke became the subject of inquiry in class. One upperclassman, who has subsequently distinguished himself in government service and business, argued passionately that the case allowed for only one defensible outcome. He maintained that we ought not allow Bakke to be debated, because our presence at the school should not be subject to debate. He recommended that we walk out of class if opposition to affirmative action was voiced. I recall thinking at the time that that advice was silly. How else were we, aspiring lawyers, to master the arguments and counterarguments regarding affirmative action other than by engaging antagonists? But I also remember biting my tongue. As a newcomer, I thought it prudent to be quiet until I got a better sense of my surroundings. Affirmative action figured, too, in another episode that remains vivid for me decades later. In my second year, in the introductory course on taxation, a black student was the first person called on. There were only two or three other black students in that class, and I made it a point to speak with them afterwards. I wanted to know whether they had felt as anxious as I had when our black classmate was called upon, and whether they had felt as relieved as I had when she displayed mastery of the relevant material. They told me that they, too, had felt personally implicated by her performance, and that they, too, had cheered silently when she answered commendably, putting the race in a good light.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?